in the morning?
Usually from around 11 to about 2 in the afternoon.
3 hours seem like a long enough time for an assignation. Did Faith know about him? Mrs. Levy shook her head.
I'm certain Ev didn't want the kids to find out. They loved their father so much, as did she, mind you, but it's been 10 years at least. That's a long time to go without companionship.
Will guessed she was speaking from experience. You said your husband's been dead for 20 years?
Yes, but I didn't like Mr. Levy very much, and he didn't care for me at all.
She used her thumb to stroke Emma's cheek.
Evelyn loved Bill. They had some bumps along the way, but it's different when you love them. They're gone and your life splinters in two. It takes an awful long time to put it back together.
Will let himself think about Sarah for just a second. The truth was that he never stopped thinking about her. She was like the news crawl that ran at the bottom of the television while his life, the main story, played on the screen. Do you know the gentleman's name?
Oh, no, dear, I never asked. But he drove a very nice Cadillac CTSV. That's the sedan, not the coupe. Black on black and the stainless steel grille on the front. A very throaty V8. You could hear it blocks away.
Will was momentarily too surprised to respond. Are you a car person?
Oh, not at all, but I looked it up on the internet because I wanted to know how much he paid for it.
Will waited her out.
I'm guessing around $75,000, the old woman confided. Mr. Levy and I bought this house for less than half that.
Did Evelyn ever tell you his name?
She never acknowledged it. Despite what you men want to think, we ladies don't sit around talking about y'all all the time.
Will allowed a smile. What did he look like?
Well, bald,
she said as if this was to be expected.
A bit paunchy around the middle. He wore jeans most of the time. His shirts were often wrinkled and he kept the sleeves rolled up, which I found rather perplexing because Evelyn always liked a sharply dressed man.
What age do you think he is?
Without the hair, it's hard to tell. I'd put him around Evelyn's age.
Early 60s.
Oh,
she seemed surprised.
I thought Evelyn was in her 40s, but I suppose that doesn't make sense with Faith being in her 30s. And the baby's not a baby anymore, is he?
She lowered her voice as if she was afraid someone would hear.
I guess it's coming up on 20 years now, but that's not the kind of pregnancy you forget. There was that bit of a scandal when she started to show. Such a pity how folks behaved. We've all had our bit of fun now and then, but as I told Evelyn at the time, a woman can run faster with her skirt up than a man can with his pants down.
Will hadn't considered Faith's teenage predicament, beyond thinking it unusual she had kept the child, but it had probably rocked the neighborhood to have a pregnant 14-year-old in their refined midst. It was almost commonplace now. But back then, a girl in Faith's predicament was generally suddenly called away to tend a never-before-mentioned frail aunt or given what was euphemistically called an appendectomy. A handful of less fortunate ones ended up in the children's home with kids like Will. He asked, "So, the man in the expensive car is in his early 60s? She nodded. "Did you ever see them being affectionate?"
No, but Evelyn wasn't the showy type. She would get in the car with him and he would drive off.
No kiss on the cheek?
Not that I ever saw. Mind you, I never even met him. Evelyn would drop Emma off here, then go back to her house and wait.
Will let that sink in. Did he ever go into her house?
Well, not that I could tell. I guess people do things differently now. In my day, a man would knock on your door and escort you to his car. There was none of this pulling up and beeping the horn.
Is that what he did? Beep the horn?
No, son, that was just a figure of speech. I suppose Ev must have been looking out the window because she always came out as soon as he pulled up.
Do you know where they went?
No, but like I said, they were usually gone for a couple of 3 hours, so I assumed they were seeing a movie or having lunch.
That was a lot of movies. Did the man show up today?
No, and I didn't see anyone in the street either. No cars, no nothing. The first I heard there was trouble was when the sirens came. Then I heard the gunshots, of course, one, and then about a minute later, one more. I know what gunfire sounds like. Mr. Levy was a hunter. Back then, all the policemen were. He used to make me go so I could cook for them.
She rolled her eyes.
What a boring gas bag he was. Rest his soul.
Lucky man to have you.
Lucky for me, he's not around anymore.
She stood with difficulty from the rocker, keeping the baby steady in her arms. The bottle was empty. She put it on the table and offered Emma to Will.
Take her for a second, will you?
He put Emma on his shoulder and patted her back. She gave an unusually rewarding burp. Mrs. Levy narrowed her eyes.
You've been around babies before.
Will wasn't about to get into his life story. They're easy to talk to. She rested her hand on his arm before going to the closet. Will had been right. There was a dark room set up in the small space. He stood in the doorway, careful not to block her light as she thumbed through a stack of 5x7 photographs. Her hands had a slight tremor, but she seemed steady on her feet. She explained,
Mr. Levy never set much store by my hobbies, but he was called onto a crime scene one day, and they asked if anyone knew a photographer. $25 they paid just for taking pictures. The old bastard wasn't going to say no to that. So he called me and told me to bring my camera. When I didn't faint over the mess, this was a shotgun incident. They said I could do it again.
She nodded toward the bed.
That Brownie 616 helped keep this roof over our heads.
He knew she meant the box camera. It looked worn, but well-loved.
I moved into surveillance work later on. Mr. Levy had drunk himself off the job by then, and, of course, I'm a woman, so it took some time for them to understand I wasn't there for flirting and screwing.
Will felt his face start to redden. Was this with the Atlanta Police Department?
58 years!
She seemed as surprised as Will that she'd lasted that long.
I may be a bag of bones now, but there was a time Geary and his ass-kissers would have snapped too instead of brushing me off like a speck of lint on their shiny trousers.
She picked through another pile of 5x7s. Will saw black and white shots of birds and various household pets, all taken from a vantage point that implied they were being spied upon rather than admired.
This little so-and-so's been digging in my flower bed.
She showed Will a picture of a gray and white cat with dirt on its nose. The lighting was harsh in the black and white print. The only thing missing was a board over his chest with his name and inmate number.
Here.
Finally, she found what she was looking for.
This is him, Evelyn's gentleman friend.
Will looked over her hunched shoulder. The photo was grainy, obviously taken from behind the blinds covering the front window. The lens pressed open thin plastic slats. A tall, older man leaned against a black Cadillac. His palms rested on the hood, forearms twisted out. The car was parked in the street, its front tires turned against the curb. Will parked his car the same way. Atlanta was a city of hills, resting on the Piedmont of the Appalachian Mountains. If you drove a car with a manual transmission, you always banked the wheels against the curb to keep the car from rolling. What is it? Faith stood in the doorway. Will passed her the baby, but she seemed more concerned with the photograph.
Did you see something?
I was showing him snippers.
Mrs. Levy had somehow pulled a sleight of hand. The photo of the man was gone, and in its place was the flower garden digging cat.
Emma shifted in Faith's arms, obviously picking up on her mother's troubled mood.
Faith kissed her on the cheek with several quick smacks and made faces until the baby smiled. Will knew Faith was putting on a show. Tears filled her eyes. She hugged the infant tightly to her chest.
Mrs. Levy spoke. Evelyn's a tough old bird. They won't break her.
Faith swayed back and forth with the baby, the way mothers automatically do.
You didn't hear anything?
Oh, darling, you know if I'd have heard something, I would have been over there with my hog leg.
Will recognized the slang for a large caliber handgun.
Ev's going to come out of this just fine. She always lands on her feet. You can take that to the bank and cash it.
Faith's voice caught. If I'd gotten here sooner, or...
She shook her head.
Why did this happen? You know Mama's not mixed up in anything bad. Why would someone take her?
Sometimes there's no rhyme or reason to the stupid things people get up to.
The old woman's shoulders twisted in a slight shrug.
All I know is that you're gonna eat yourself alive if you keep going down that road asking, what if I did this or what if I did that?
She pressed the back of her fingers to Faith's cheek.
Trust in the Lord to look over her. Lean not into thine own understanding.
Faith nodded, solemn, though Will had never known her to be religious.
Thank you.
Amanda's heels thudded down the carpeted hallway.
I can't stall them anymore, she told Faith. There's a cruiser outside waiting to take you to the station. Try to shut up and do what your lawyer says.
The least I can do is watch the baby, Mrs. Levy offered. You don't need to take her down to that filthy station, and Jeremy wouldn't know which end the diaper goes on.
Faith obviously wanted to take her up on the offer, but she hedged.
I don't know how long I'll be.
You know I'm a night owl. It's no bother.
Thank you.
Faith reluctantly handed the baby to the old woman. She smoothed down Emma's crop of fine brown hair and kissed the top of her head. Her lips stayed there for a few seconds more, then she left without another word. As soon as the front door closed, Amanda cut to the chase.
What?
Mrs. Levy pulled the photograph from under her apron. Evelyn had a frequent visitor, Will explained. Mrs. Levy had a good memory. The man was bald, his jeans were baggy, his shirt was wrinkled, the sleeves rolled up. She'd failed to mention a more important detail, which was that he was Hispanic. The tattoo on his arm was blurry, but Will easily recognized the symbol on his forearm that identified him as Los Texicanos. Amanda folded the picture in half before sticking it into the pocket of her suit jacket. She asked Mrs. Levy,
Have the uniforms talked to you yet?
I'm sure they'll get around to the little old ladies eventually.
I assume you'll be as cooperative as usual.
She smiled.
I'm not sure what I can tell them, but I'll go ahead and lay out some fresh cookies in case they come calling.
Amanda chuckled.
Careful, Roz.
She motioned for Will to follow her as she left the room. Will reached into his wallet and pulled out one of his cards for Mrs. Levy.
This has all my numbers. Call me if you remember anything or if you need help with the baby.
Thank you, Sonny.
Her voice had lost some of its old lady kindness, but she tucked the card into her apron anyway. Amanda was halfway up the hall by the time Will joined her. She didn't say anything about the photograph or Faith's condition or the pissing contest she'd had with Geary. Instead, she started giving him orders.
I need you to review all of your case files from the investigation.
She didn't have to tell him which investigation she meant.
Comb through every witness statement, every CI report, every jailhouse snitch's last hurrah. I don't care how small it is, I want to know about it.
Amanda stopped. He knew she was thinking about his reading issues. He kept his voice steady.
It's not a problem.
She wouldn't let him off that easy.
Pull up your panties, Will. If you need help, speak up now so I can deal with it.
Do you want me to start now? The boxes are at my house.
No. We've got an errand to run first.
She stood in the foyer, her hands on her hips. She was a trim woman, and Will often forgot how short she was until he saw her straining her neck to look up at him.
I managed to pry some information loose while Geary was throwing his tantrum. The Texicano in the backyard has helpfully identified himself as Ricardo, vis-a-vis the large tattoo on his back. We don't have a full ID on him yet. He's mid-20s, approximately 5'9 and 170 pounds. The Asian in the bedroom is around 40 years of age, slightly shorter and thinner than his Hispanic friend. I would guess he's not from this part of town. He might have been brought in just for this.
Will remembered. Faith said he had a southern drawl.
That should help narrow things down.
He was also wearing a loud Hawaiian shirt that's not very gangsterish.
We'll add that to his list of crimes.
She glanced down the hallway, then looked back at Will.
Now the Asian in the laundry room is an odd story too, which we know courtesy of the wallet he carried in his back pocket. Hironobu Kwan, age 19. He's a freshman at Georgia State. He's also the son of a local school teacher, Miriam Kwan.
He's not affiliated?
Not that we can find. APD swooped up Mama Kwan before we could get to her. We'll have to find her tomorrow morning to see what she knows.
She pointed her finger at Will.
Softly, softly. We're still not officially on the case. It's just you and me until I can find a way in.
He said, Faith seems to think the Texicanos were looking for something. Will tried to gauge Amanda's expression. Usually it hovered somewhere between amused and annoyed, but now it was completely blank. Ricardo was beaten to a pulp. He had a gun pointed at his head. He wasn't looking for anything except to save his life. It's the Asians we should be talking to first.
That seems entirely logical.
It points to a larger problem, he continued. The Texicanos I can understand, but what would the Asians want with Evelyn? What's their play?
That's the million-dollar question.
He put a finer point on it. Evelyn headed the drug squad. Los Texicanos control the drug trade in Atlanta. They have for the last 20 years.
They certainly have.
Will felt the familiar sting of his head hitting a brick wall. This was the same runaround Amanda always gave him when she had information that she wasn't going to share. Somehow, this time was worse, because she wasn't just screwing with his head. She was covering for her old friend. He tried. You said that the guy in the Hawaiian shirt was probably brought in for this. What's this? Kidnapping? Finding whatever Evelyn had hidden in her house?
I don't think anyone is finding what they're looking for today.
She paused to let her meaning sink in.
Charlie's helping out the locals with the crime scene, but they're not as weak to his charms as I'd like. His access has been very limited and closely supervised. They say they'll share lab results. I'm iffy on their ME.
The Fulton County Medical Examiner. Has he shown up?
He's still combing through that apartment fire in Peoplestown.
Budget cuts had left the medical examiner's office devastated. If there was more than one serious crime happening within the city limits, that usually meant the detectives were in for a long wait.
I'd love to get Pete on this.
She was referring to the GBI's medical examiner. Will asked,
Can't he make some phone calls? Unlikely,
she admitted.
Pete's not exactly covered up in friends. You know how strange he is. He makes you look normal. What about Sarah?
She'll keep her mouth shut.
I'm aware of that, Will. I saw your do-si-do in the street. I meant, do you think she knows anyone in the ME's office?
Will shrugged.
Ask her,
Amanda ordered. Will doubted Sarah would welcome the call, but he nodded his agreement anyway. What about Evelyn's credit card statements, phone records?
I've ordered them pulled.
Does she have GPS in her car, on her phones? She didn't really answer him.
We are going through some backdoor channels. As I said, this isn't exactly above board.
But what you told Geary is right.
We've got original jurisdiction over drug cases. Just because Evelyn was in charge of the narcotics division doesn't mean this is drug-related. From what I've gathered, they found no indication of drugs in the house or on any of the dead men. And Ricardo, the dead Texicano of the drug-related Texicanos? Odd coincidence. How about the living, breathing, drug-related Texicano who drives a black Cadillac that Evelyn Mitchell has no qualms about getting into and going for a ride? She feigned surprise. You think he's affiliated? I saw the tattoo in the photograph. Evelyn's been seeing a Texicano for at least 4 months. Will tried to moderate his tone. He's older. He must be higher up in the organization. Mrs. Levy says the visits have stepped up over the last 10 days. They've been going somewhere together in his car, usually out by 11 and back by 2. Again, Amanda ignored his point and made her own. You busted 6 detectives on Evelyn's squad. 2 of them were paroled for good behavior last year, both transferred out of state, 1 to California, 1 to Tennessee, which is where they were this afternoon when Evelyn was taken. 2 are in medium security at Valdosta State, 4 years away from release and no good behavior in sight. 1 is dead, drug overdose, which is what I call the thinking man's karma. The last one is waiting to get his dance card punched at DNC. The Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison. Death row. Will reluctantly asked, who'd he kill? A guard and an inmate. Strangled a convicted rapist with a towel, no loss there, but then he beat the guard to death with his bare hands. Claimed it was self-defense. Against the guard. You sound like the prosecutor on his case.
Will tried again. And Evelyn?
What about her?
I investigated her, too.
You did?
We're not going to talk about the elephant in the room?
Elephant? For Christ's sakes, Will, we've got the entire goddamn circus in here.
She opened the front door. The sun cut through the dark house like a knife. Amanda slipped on her sunglasses as they walked across the lawn toward the crime scene. A pair of uniformed cops were making their way toward Mrs. Levy's house. They each glowered at Will and gave Amanda a curt nod. She mumbled to Will,
about time they got going,
as if she hadn't been the cause of the delay. He waited until the men started banging on the front door. I guess you know Mrs. Levy from your days with the APD.
GBI. I investigated her for murdering her husband.
Amanda seemed to enjoy Will's horrified expression.
Never could prove it, but I'm sure she poisoned him.
Cookies? He guessed.
That was my working theory.
An appreciative smile curved her lips as she picked her way across the grass.
Roz is a wily old coot. Seen more crime scenes than all of us rolled together, and I'm sure she took notes the entire time. I wouldn't trust half of what she told you. Remember, the devil can cite scripture for his purpose.
Amanda had a point, or at least Shakespeare did. Still, Will reminded her, Mrs. Levy's the one who told me about the Texicano visiting Evelyn. She took the picture of him.
She did, didn't she?
Will felt the question hit him like a slap to the back of his head. Considering Mrs. Levy's artistic talent lent itself more to unflattering mugshots of household pets, it seemed strange that she just happened to have handy a photograph of the Texicano standing beside his black Cadillac. She was a sharp old lady. She'd been spying for a reason. We should go back and talk to her.
Do you really think she's going to tell us anything useful?
Will silently conceded the point. Mrs. Levy seemed to like her games, and with Evelyn missing, they didn't really have time to play them. Does Evelyn know she killed her husband?
Of course she does.
And she still let her watch Emma? They had reached Faith's mini. Amanda cupped her hands to the glass and peered inside.
She killed a 64-year-old abusive alcoholic, not a 4-month-old baby.
Will guessed somewhere in the world this kind of logic made sense. Amanda headed toward the house. Charlie Reed was in the carport talking to a bunch of other crime scene unit techs. Some were smoking,
One was leaning against a tan Malibu that was parked nose out to Faith's Mini. They were all dressed in white Tyvek clean suits that made them look like various sizes of soiled marshmallows. Charlie's handlebar mustache was the only thing that distinguished him from the clean-shaven men. He saw Amanda and broke away from the group. She said, "Take me through it, Charlie." Charlie glanced back at a portly, dark man whose odd build made the Tyvek suit unflatteringly tight in all the critical areas. The man took a last puff on his cigarette and handed it to one of his co-workers. He introduced himself to Amanda in a clipped, British-sounding accent.
"Dr. Wagner, I am Dr. Abidi Mittal."
She indicated Will.
"This is Dr. Trent, my associate."
Will shook the man's hand, trying not to cringe at the effortless way Amanda rolled out a degree they both know he'd obtained from a dubious online school. Mittal offered, "As a courtesy, I am prepared to show you around the crime scene." Amanda gave a cutting glance to Charlie, as if he had any say in the matter. "Thank you," Will said, because he knew no one else would. Mittal handed each of them a pair of white booties for their shoes. Amanda grabbed Will's arm to steady herself as she slipped off her heels and covered her stocking feet. Will was left to hop around on his own. Even without his shoes, his feet were too big, and he ended up looking like Mrs. Levy with her heels hanging off the back of her slippers. "Shall we start in here?" Mittal didn't wait for them to acknowledge his invitation. He led them around the back of the Malibu and into the house through the open kitchen door. Instinctively, Will ducked his head as he walked into the low-ceilinged room. Charlie bumped into him and mumbled an apology. The kitchen was small for four people, horseshoe-shaped, with the open end facing the laundry room. Will caught the distinct odor of rusty iron that blood gave off when it congealed. Faith was right. The intruders had been looking for something. The house was a mess. Silverware was scattered on the floor, drawers had been thrown around, holes were knocked in the walls, a cell phone and an older-looking BlackBerry were crushed on the floor. The wall phone had been smashed off the hook. Except for the black fingerprint powder and the yellow plastic markers the forensics team had used, nothing had been altered from what Faith said she'd first seen when she entered the house. Even the dead body was still in the laundry room. Faith must have been terrified, not knowing what was coming around the corner. Terrified that her mother was injured. Or worse. Will should have been here. He should have been the kind of partner Faith knew she could call no matter what. Mittal said, "I've yet to write my report, but I'm prepared to share my working theory." Amanda rolled her hand in a circle to move things along.
"Tell me what you've got."
Mittal's lips pursed at the commanding tone.
"I assume that Captain Mitchell was preparing lunch when the crime commenced."
There were bags of cold cuts on the counter beside a knife and cutting board where Evelyn had obviously been slicing tomatoes. An empty Wonder Bread sleeve was wadded up in the sink. The toaster had popped up long ago. Four slices of bread. Evelyn had probably known Faith would need lunch when she got home. It was a normal enough scene. Even pleasant, but for the fact that every item on the counter was spattered or smeared with blood. The toaster, the bread, the cutting board. More blood had dripped down to the floor and pooled onto the tiles. Two sets of red shoe prints crisscrossed the white porcelain, one small, one large. There had been a struggle. Mittal continued,
"Captain Mitchell was startled by a noise, possibly the sliding glass door breaking, which likely made her cut her finger with the knife she was using to slice the tomatoes."
Amanda noted,
"That's a lot of blood for a kitchen accident."
Mittal obviously didn't want any editorial comments. He paused again before continuing.
"The infant, Emma, would have been here."
He pointed to the counter space beside the fridge, opposite the area where Evelyn had been preparing lunch.
"We found a small drop of blood on the counter, here."
He pointed to the spot beside an older model CD player.
"There's a blood trail to and from the shed, so Captain Mitchell was most likely bleeding when she left the kitchen. Her handprint on the door supports this."
Amanda nodded.
She hears a noise, so she hides the baby to keep her safe, then comes back in with her S&W.
Charlie's words came out in a rush, as if he could no longer hold his tongue.
She must have wrapped a paper towel around the cut, but it bled through quickly. There's blood on the kitchen door and the wooden handle of the S&W.
Will asked, what about the car seat?
It's clean. She must have carried it with her uninjured hand. We've got a blood trail back and forth across the carport where she carried Emma to the shed. It's Evelyn's blood. Abidi's people already typed it, so we can kind of puzzle it out from that.
He glanced up at Mittal.
Sorry, Abi. I hope I'm not stepping on your toes.
Mittal made an expansive gesture with his hands, indicating Charlie should continue. Will knew that this was Charlie's favorite part of the job. There was a swagger to his walk as he went to the open doorway and clasped his hands together near his face, as if he held a gun.
Evelyn comes back into the house, pivots, sees bad guy number one waiting in the laundry room, and shoots him in the head. The force spun him around like a pinwheel. That's the exit wound you see at the back of his head.
Charlie turned back around, hands raised again in a classic Charlie's Angel pose, which was the best way to make sure you got shot in the chest.
Then bad guy number two comes, probably from over there.
He pointed to the pass-through between the kitchen and dining room.
There's a struggle. Evelyn loses her gun, see there?
Will followed his pointing finger to a plastic marker on the floor. Now that Charlie had put the suggestion in his head, he could see the faint, bloody outline of a handgun.
Evelyn grabs the knife off the counter. Her blood is on the handle, but it's not on the blade.
Amanda interrupted.
It's not just her blood on the knife.
No, according to her personnel file, Evelyn is typed as O positive. We've got B negative coating the blade and here by the fridge.
They all looked down at a dozen large, round drops of blood on the floor. Mittal provided,
it's a passive spatter.
No arteries were compromised or there would be a spray pattern. All the samples were sent to the lab for DNA analysis. I imagine we're looking at a week for results.
A smile played at Amanda's lips as she stared at the blood.
Good girl, Ev.
There was a sound of triumph in her voice.
Any of the dead guys be negative?
Charlie glanced at Mittal again. The man nodded his acquiescence.
The Asian in the ugly shirt was O positive, which is a fairly common type across races. It's Evelyn's type, it's my type. The other, the guy we're calling Ricardo because of his tattoo, was B negative. But here's the kicker. He doesn't have any stab wounds. I mean, he bled at some point. He was obviously tortured, but the blood we're looking at here is a larger volume than anything.
Amanda interrupted.
So, we've got someone out there with a stab wound whose blood type is B negative. Is that rare? Less than 2% of the U.S. Caucasian population is B negative,
Charlie told them.
It's a quarter of that for Asians and around 1% for Hispanics. Bottom line, it's a very rare blood type, which makes it probable that our dead B negative, Ricardo, is genetically related to our missing and wounded B negative.
So we've got a wounded man out there, blood type B negative.
Charlie was ahead of her for once.
I already put a B on the lookout at all hospitals within 100 miles for a stab wound of any kind. Male, female, white, black, orange. We've already had 3 rule-outs from domestics just in the last half hour. More people get stabbed than I'd realized.
Mittal made sure Charlie was finished, then pointed to the blood smeared across the floor.
These shoe prints are conducive to a struggle between a small woman and a medium-sized man, probably around 70 kilos. We can tell from the variation of light to dark in the print that there is a medial roll to the foot, or supination.
Amanda stopped the lesson.
Take me back to the stab wound. Are we talking fatal?
Mittal shrugged.
The medical examiner's office would have to give you their opinion. As was stated earlier, there's no blood spray on the walls or ceiling, from which we can posit that none of the arteries were damaged. This spatter, then, could perhaps be the result of a head wound, where one would find a fair amount of blood with minimal damage.
He looked at Charlie.
Do you concur?
Charlie nodded but added,
A gut wound might bleed like this. I'm not sure how long you could last with that. If you trust the movies, not long. If a lung was punctured, then he'd have an hour tops before he suffocated. There's absolutely no arterial spray, so it's a seeping wound. I don't disagree with Dr. Mittal about the possibility of a head wound.
He shrugged, then disagreed anyway.
The blade was coated tip to hilt, which might indicate that the knife plunged into the body.
He saw the frown on Mittal's face and backpedaled.
Then again, it could be that the victim grabbed the knife, which cut his hand and coated the blade through transfer.
He showed his hand, palm up.
In which case, we'd have a B-negative out there with a wounded hand as well.
Amanda had never embraced the equivocations of crime scene science. She tried to sum it up in absolutes.
So, bad guy B-negative struggles with Evelyn. Then I suppose we bring in the second man, the Asian in the Hawaiian shirt, who later ended up dead in the bedroom. They manage to subdue Evelyn and take away her gun. And then there's a third man, Ricardo, who was a hostage at one point and then became a shooter. And then, thanks to Agent Mitchell's quick action, became dead before he could injure anyone.
She turned to Will.
My money is on Ricardo being hooked up in all of this, torture or not. He pretended to be a hostage to try to leverage Faith.
Mittal looked uncomfortable with the finality in her tone.
That is an interpretation.
Charlie tried to smooth things over.
There's always the chance that...
There was a sound similar to the rush of a tropical waterfall. Mittal unzipped his clean suit and felt around in his pants pockets. He pulled out his cell phone and said, "If you will excuse me," before heading back into the garage. Amanda turned to Charlie.
Brass tacks.
They're not giving me full access, but there's no reason for me to disagree with what Abby said so far.
And?
I don't want to sound racist, Charlie began, but you don't often see Mexicans and Asians working together, especially Los Texicanos.
Younger kids aren't as hung up on that sort of thing, Will offered, wondering if that could be called progress. Amanda didn't acknowledge either comment.
What else?
The list by the phone.
Charlie pointed to a piece of yellow paper with a bunch of numbers and names.
I took the liberty to call the number for Zeke. I left a message for him to get in touch with you.
Amanda looked at her watch.
What about the rest of the house? Did forensics find anything?
Not that they've told me. Abby's not being overtly rude, but he's not going out of his way to volunteer anything either.
Charlie paused before adding,
It seems obvious whatever the bad guys were looking for wasn't found, otherwise they would have cleared out the minute Faith pulled up.
And we'd be planning Evelyn's funeral.
Amanda didn't dwell on the fact.
Whatever they were searching for, what would you guess the size of this mysterious item to be?
No telling,
Charlie admitted.
Obviously, they were looking everywhere, drawers, closets, cushions. I think they got angrier as they went through the house and started destroying on top of searching. They ripped open the beds, broke the baby's toys. There's a lot of fury in there.
How many searchers?
I'm sorry, Dr. Wagner.
Mittal was back. He tucked his phone into his pocket but left his white suit gaping open. That was the M.E., He's been delayed by the discovery of another body at the apartment fire. What was your question? Charlie answered for her, perhaps sensing that Amanda's tone might get them thrown out of the house.
She was asking how many searchers you thought there were.
Mittal nodded.
Uneducated guess would be 3 to 4 men.
Will saw the disgusted look on Amanda's face. It had to be more than 3. Otherwise, all the suspects were dead and Evelyn Mitchell had kidnapped herself. Mittal continued.
They did not wear gloves. Perhaps they thought Captain Mitchell would relent without a struggle.
Amanda snorted a laugh, and Mittal gave another one of his patented pauses.
There are fingerprints on most surfaces, which, of course, we will share with the GBI.
Charlie said, I've already called the lab. We've got 2 techs coming in to digitize them and put them in the database. From there, it's only a matter of time before we know if they're in the system. Amanda indicated the kitchen.
Once Evelyn was neutralized, they would have started their search in here. They were looking through drawers, so it's something that would fit in a drawer.
She looked up at Charlie, then Mittal.
Any tire tracks?
Footprints?
Nothing of consequence.
Mittal walked her over to the kitchen window and started pointing out things in the backyard that had been checked. Will studied the broken CDs on the floor. Beatles, Sinatra. No AC/DC. The player was white plastic, smudged with black fingerprint powder. Will used his thumbnail to press the eject button. The tray was empty. Amanda's voice came back to him.
Where did they keep Evelyn while they were tearing up the house?
Mittal started toward the living room. Will took up the rear as Charlie and Amanda followed the doctor through the path of debris. The setup was similar to Mrs. Levy's house, minus the sunken aspect of the living room. Opposite the couch and a wingback chair were a wall of bookshelves and a small plasma screen television with a foot-sized crack in the center. Most of the books were strewn across the floor. The couch and chairs had been gutted, their frames broken. There was a stereo on the shelf by the TV, the old record-playing kind, but the speakers were busted and the arm had been wrenched off the turntable. A small pile of vinyl records had obviously met the hard edge of someone's heel. There was a Tonet-style bentwood chair against the wall, the only thing in the room that seemed to have remained intact. The seat was thatched. The legs were scuffed. Mittal pointed to where chunks of veneer had been ripped off.
It appears that duct tape was used. I found adhesive where Captain Mitchell's feet would have been.
He lifted up the chair and moved it away from the wall. A yellow plastic number marker had been placed beside a dark stain.
One can surmise from the blood drops on the carpet that Captain Mitchell's hands were hanging down. The cut to her finger was still bleeding, but not with any significance. Perhaps my colleague is correct in assuming that she wrapped the wound in a paper towel.
Amanda leaned down to look at the bloodstain, but Will was more interested in the chair. Evelyn's hands had been tied behind her back. He used his foot to tilt the chair forward so he could see the bottom of the thatched seat. There was a mark underneath, an arrowhead, drawn in blood. Will looked out into the room, trying to figure out what the arrow was pointing to. The couch directly across from the chair was gutted, as was the wingback chair to the side. The hardwood floors meant nothing could be hidden under a carpet. Was Evelyn pointing to something in the backyard? He heard a hiss of air through teeth. Will glanced up to find Amanda giving him such a searing look that he dropped the chair back into place without his brain being aware of what his foot was doing. She gave a slight shake of her head, indicating he should keep his mouth shut about the find. Will glanced at Charlie. They had all three seen the arrow under the chair, while Mittal, oblivious, waxed poetic on the efficacy of fingerprinting on porous versus non-porous surfaces. Charlie opened his mouth to speak, but Amanda talked over him.
Dr. Mittal, in your opinion, was the glass door broken with a found object, such as a rock or lawn ornament?
She glared at Charlie, and Will thought if she was capable of shooting lasers from her eyes, they would have sealed Charlie's mouth shut.
I'm just wondering how well this attack was planned. Did they bring something to break the glass? Did they surround the house? If so, did they know the layout ahead of time?
Mittal frowned because these were questions none of them were capable of answering.
Dr. Wagner, these are not scenarios that can be forensically evaluated.
Well, let's just toss it around and see what sticks. Was a brick used to break the glass?
Charlie started shaking his head. Will recognized the internal conflict. Like it or not, this was Mittal's crime scene, and there was evidence under the chair, possibly important evidence, that the man had missed. Charlie was obviously torn. As with most things that had to do with Amanda, there was the right thing to do, and then there was the thing that she was ordering him to do. Each decision had its consequence. Mittal was shaking his head too, but only because Amanda wasn't making sense.
Dr. Wagner, we have searched every inch of this crime scene, and I'm telling you, we have not found any more items of substance than what I have already detailed.
Will knew for a fact they hadn't checked every inch. He asked, has anyone checked the Malibu? That took Charlie's mind off his troubles. His brow furrowed. Will had made the same mistake with Faith's Mini. All of the violence had taken place inside the house, but the cars were still part of the crime scene. Amanda was the first to move. She had made her way out to the carport and opened the driver's side door of the Malibu before anyone thought to ask her what she was doing. Mital said, "Please, we've not yet processed." She gave him a withering look.
"Did you think to check the trunk?"
His stunned silence was enough of an answer. Amanda popped the trunk. Will was standing just inside the kitchen doorway, which gave him a raised view of the scene. There were several plastic grocery bags in the trunk, their contents flattened down by the dead body on top of them. As in the kitchen, blood coated everything, soaking into the cereal box, dripping down the plastic wrap around the hamburger buns. The dead man was a big guy. His body was folded almost in two where he'd been bent to fit into the space. A deep gash in his bald head showed splintered bone and bits of brain. His jeans were wrinkled. His shirt sleeves were rolled up. There was a Los Texicanos tattoo on his forearm. Evelyn's gentleman friend. Chapter 4. The Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison was located in Jackson, about an hour south of Atlanta. The drive was usually a quick shot down I-75, but the Atlanta Motor Speedway was having some kind of exhibition event that slowed traffic to a crawl. Undeterred, Amanda kept hopping on and off the shoulder, jerking the wheel quickly to pass groups of sluggish cars. The SUV's tires made a strumming sound as they grazed the rumble strips, meant to deter drivers from leaving the roadway. Between the noise and the vibration, Will found himself fighting an unexpected wave of motion sickness. Finally, they made it through the worst of the traffic. At the speedway exit, Amanda took one last dash onto the shoulder, then popped the SUV back onto the road. The tires skipped. The chassis shook. Will rolled down the window for some fresh air to help settle his stomach. The wind slapped his face so hard that he felt his skin ripple. Amanda pressed the button to roll the window back up, giving him the look she reserved for stupid people and children. They were going over 100 miles an hour. Will was lucky he hadn't been sucked out the window. She let out a long sigh as she stared back at the road. One hand rested in her lap, while the other was firmly wrapped around the steering wheel. She was wearing her usual power suit, a bright blue skirt, and matching jacket with a light-colored blouse underneath. Her high-heel shoes exactly matched the color of her suit. Her fingernails were trim but manicured. Her hair was its usual helmet of salt-and-pepper gray. Most days, Amanda seemed to have more energy than all the men on her team. Now she looked tired, and Will could see the worry lines around her eyes were more pronounced. She said,
"Tell me about Spivey."
Will tried to click his brain back over to his old case against Captain Evelyn Mitchell's team. Boyd Spivey was the former lead detective on the narcotics squad, who was currently biding his time on death row. Will had talked to the man only once before Spivey's lawyers advised him to keep his mouth shut. "I don't find it hard to believe he'd beat someone to death with his fists. He was a big guy, taller than me, carried about 50 more pounds, all of it muscle."
"Gym rat?"
"I'd guess steroids gave him a boost."
"How did that work for him?"
"They made him uncontrollably angry," Will recalled. "He's not as smart as he thinks, but I wasn't able to get him to confess, so maybe I'm not either."
"You still sent him to prison?"
"He sent himself to prison. His house in the city was paid for. His house at the lake was paid for. All three of his kids were in private school. His wife worked 10 hours a week and drove a top-of-the-line Mercedes. His mistress drove a BMW. He kept his brand-new Porsche 911 parked in her driveway."
"Men and their cars," she mumbled. "He doesn't sound very smart to me."
"He didn't think anyone would ask questions."
"Generally, they don't."
"Spivey was good at keeping his mouth shut."
"As I recall, all of them were."
She was right. In a corruption case, the usual strategy was to find the weakest member and persuade him or her to turn on his or her fellow conspirators in exchange for a lighter sentence. The six detectives belonging to Evelyn Mitchell's narcotic squad had proven immune to this strategy. None of them would turn on the other, and all of them routinely insisted that Captain Mitchell had nothing to do with their alleged crimes. They went out of their way to protect their boss. It was both admirable and incredibly frustrating. Will said, "Spivey worked on Evelyn's squad for 12 years, longer than any of them.
She trusted him."
"Yes," Will agreed. "Two peas in a pod." Amanda cut him a sharp look.
"Careful."
Will felt his jaw tighten so hard that the bone ached. He didn't see how ignoring the most important part of this case was going to get them anywhere. Amanda knew as well as Will that her friend was guilty as hell. Evelyn hadn't lived large, but like Spivey, she'd been stupid in her own way. Faith's father had been an insurance broker, solidly middle class with the usual kinds of debts that people had. Car payments, mortgage, credit cards. Yet, during Will's investigation, he'd found an out-of-state bank account in Bill Mitchell's name. At the time, the man had been dead for 6 years. Though the account balance always hovered around $10,000, the activity showed monthly deposits since his death that totaled up to almost $60,000. It was clearly a shell account, the kind of thing prosecutors called a smoking gun. With Bill dead, Evelyn was the only signatory. Money was taken out and deposited with her ATM card at an Atlanta branch of the bank. Her dead husband wasn't the one who was keeping the activities spread apart and the deposit shy of the limit that would throw up a red flag at Homeland Security. As far as Will knew, Evelyn Mitchell had never been asked about the account. He'd figured it would come out during her trial, but her trial had never happened. There had been a press conference announcing her retirement, and that was the end of the story. Until now. Amanda flipped down the visor to block the sun. Clipped to the underside were a couple of yellow claim tickets that looked like they were from a dry cleaner. The sun wasn't doing her any favors. She didn't look tired anymore. She looked haggard. She said, "Something's bothering you." He resisted uttering the biggest duh ever vocalized in the history of the world. "Not that," she said as if she could read his mind. "Faith didn't call you for help because she knew that she was going to do the wrong thing." Will looked out the window. "You would have made her wait for backup." He hated the relief her words brought. "She's always been headstrong." He felt the need to say, "She didn't do the wrong thing." "That's my boy." Will watched the trees along the highway blend into a sea of green. "Do you think there's going to be a ransom?"
"I hope so."
They both knew that a ransom pointed to a living hostage, or at least the opportunity to demand proof of life. He said, "This feels personal."
"How so?"
He shook his head. "The way the house was torn up. There's mad, and then there's furious."
"I don't imagine the old girl sat by quietly while they performed their search."
"Probably not." Evelyn Mitchell was no Amanda Wagner, but Will could easily see her taunting the men who were tearing up her house. You didn't get to be one of the first female captains on the Atlanta police force by being sweet. They were obviously looking for money.
"Why do you say that?"
"Clams. The last word Ricardo said to Faith before he died. You said it's slang for money. Ergo, they were looking for money."
"In the silverware drawer."
Another good point. Cash was nice, but it was cumbersome. A pile worth kidnapping an ex-Atlanta police captain for would fill several silverware drawers. He said, "The arrow was pointing into the backyard."
"What arrow?"
Will suppressed a groan. She wasn't usually this obvious. The arrow drawn in Evelyn's blood underneath the chair she was duct-taped to. "I know you saw it. You hissed at me like an air compressor."
"You really should work on your metaphors."
She was silent for a beat, probably considering the most circuitous route to take him to nowhere.
"You think Evelyn has buried treasure in her backyard?"
He had to admit this was unlikely, especially considering the Mitchell backyard was on full display to the rest of the neighbors, most of whom were retired and seemed to have ample time to spy. Besides, Will couldn't picture Faith's mother out with a shovel and a flashlight in the middle of the night. Then again, it wasn't like she could put it in the bank. Safe deposit box? Will tried. Maybe they were looking for a key.
Evelyn would have to go to the bank and sign in to get access. They'd compare her signature, ask for her ID. Our kidnapper had to know her picture would be on every television station the minute he took her.
Will silently conceded the point. Besides, the same rule applied. A large amount of cash took up space. Diamonds and gold were more for Hollywood movies. In real life, stolen jewels fetched pennies on the dollar.
She asked, "What about the crime scene? Do you think Charlie got it right?"
Will went on the defense. Mital did most of the talking.
"Okay, you've covered Charlie's ass. Now answer my question."
"The Los Texicanos in the trunk of the Malibu. Evelyn's gentleman friend.
He throws it all out."
She nodded.
"He wasn't stabbed. He died from a shot to the head. Plus, he's B positive. That still leaves us with our B negative out there with a nasty wound."
"That's not what I'm talking about." Will resisted the urge to add, "and you know it." Amanda wasn't just tying his hands behind his back. She was blindfolding him and sending him toward the edge of a cliff. Her refusal to talk about or even acknowledge Evelyn Mitchell's sordid past wasn't going to help Faith, and it sure as hell wasn't going to get her mother back in one piece. Evelyn had worked in narcotics. She was obviously in contact almost daily with a higher-up in Los Texicanos, the gang that ran the drug trade in and out of Atlanta. They should be back in the city talking to the gang units and putting together the last few weeks of Evelyn's life, not making a fool's errand to visit a guy who had nothing to lose and a history of stubborn silence.
"Come on, Dr. Trent," Amanda chided. "Don't make me pull teeth."
Will let his ego get in the way for a few more seconds before saying, "Evelyn's gentleman friend. His wallet was missing. He didn't have any ID or money on him. The only thing in his pockets was the key to Evelyn's Malibu. She must have given it to him."
"Keep going."
She was making lunch for two people. There were four slices of bread in the toaster. Faith was late. Evelyn didn't know what time she'd be home, but she would assume Faith would call when she was on her way. There were groceries in the trunk of the Malibu. The receipt says Evelyn used her debit card at the Kroger at 12:02. The gentleman was bringing in the groceries while she fixed lunch. Amanda smiled.
"I often forget how smart you are, but then something like this happens and it makes me realize why I hired you."
Will ignored the backhanded compliment. "So, Evelyn's making lunch. She starts to wonder where her gentleman friend is. She goes outside and finds his body in the trunk. She grabs Emma and hides her in the shed. If she'd grabbed Emma after cutting her hand, like Dr. Mital said, there would have been blood somewhere on the car seat. Evelyn's strong, but she's not Hercules. The car seat, even without a baby in it, is pretty heavy. She couldn't deadlift one of those things off the counter with one hand. At least not safely. She'd have to cup the bottom with her free hand. Emma's little, but she's got some heft to her." Amanda supplied,
"Evelyn spent time in the shed. She moved the blankets around. There's no blood on them. She dialed the combination lock on the safe. There's no blood on the dial. The floor is clean. She was bleeding after she locked the door."
"I'm not an expert on kitchen injuries, but you don't generally cut your ring finger when you're slicing something. It's usually the thumb or the index finger."
"Another good point."
Amanda checked the rearview mirror and changed lanes.
"Okay, what did she do next?"
"Like you said, Evelyn hides the baby, then gets her gun out of the safe, goes back into the house, and shoots Quan, who's waiting to ambush her from the laundry room. Then she's overpowered by a second man, probably our mystery blood type B negative. Evelyn's gun gets knocked out of her hand during the struggle. She stabs B negative, but there's a third guy, Mr. Hawaiian Shirt. He gets Evelyn's gun off the floor and stops the struggle. He asks her where the thing is that they're looking for. She tells them to go to hell. She's duct taped to the chair while they search the house.
That sounds plausible.
It sounded confusing. There were so many bad guys that Will was having a hard time keeping track of them. Two Asians, one Hispanic, possibly two, maybe a third man, race unknown. A house being searched for God only knew what, and a missing 63-year-old ex-cop who had her share of secrets. Then there was the even larger question that Will knew better than to ask. Why hadn't Evelyn called for help? By Will's count, she'd had at least two opportunities to make a call or run for help. When she first heard the noise, and after she shot Hironobu Kwan in the laundry room. And yet, she had stayed.
What are you thinking?
Will knew better than to give an honest answer. I'm wondering how they got her out of the house without anyone seeing. Amanda reminded him,
You're assuming Roz Levy is being forthcoming.
Do you think she's involved in this?
I think she's a wily old bitch who wouldn't piss on you if your hair was on fire.
Will supposed the venom in her tone came from experience. Amanda said,
This wasn't spur of the moment. Some planning went into it. They didn't all walk there. There was a car somewhere, maybe a van. There's a dogleg alley jutting into Little John Trail. They would have gone out the back, exiting into Evelyn's backyard. You follow the fence line between the neighbors and you're there in 2 minutes.
How many men do you think were there?
We've got three dead on scene. There's the injured B-negative and at least one able-bodied man. There's no way Evelyn would have gone to a second location without a fight. She would have risked being shot first. There had to be someone there who was strong enough to tie her up or subdue her.
Will didn't add that they could have just as easily injured or killed her and removed the body. We'll know for sure when we get the fingerprints. They all must have touched something. Abruptly, Amanda changed the subject.
Have you and Faith ever talked about your case against your mother?
Not really. I've never told her about the bank account because there's no reason. She assumes I was wrong. A lot of people do. My case was never made in court. Evelyn retired with full benefits. It's not a hard conclusion to jump to. She nodded as if she was giving her approval.
The man in the trunk, the one you call Evelyn's gentleman friend. Let's talk about him.
If he was bringing in groceries, that implies they had a personal relationship.
That's certainly possible.
Will thought about the guy. He'd been shot in the back of the head. His wallet and ID were not the only things missing from his person. He didn't have a cell phone. He didn't have the thick gold watch he'd been wearing in the picture Mrs. Levy had taken. His clothes were nondescript. Nikes with Dr. Scholl's orthopedic inserts. J. Crew jeans, and a Banana Republic shirt that had cost a lot of money considering he hadn't bothered to iron it. There was a smattering of gray in the black goatee on his chin. The stubble on his shiny head indicated he was hiding male pattern baldness rather than making a bold statement in style. Except for the Los Texicanos star on his forearm, he could have been a stockbroker having a midlife crisis. Amanda said,
I've checked with narcotics. There have been some grumblings about the Asians making a play for the powder cocaine trade. It's been up for grabs since the BMF went down.
The Black Mafia family. They had controlled coke sales from Atlanta to L.A. with Detroit in between. That's a lot of money. The family was pulling down hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Los Texicanos was calling the shots. They've always been suppliers, not distributors. It's a smart way to play it. That's why they've survived all these years. Despite what Charlie thinks about race, they don't care if the dealer is black or brown or purple so long as the money's green.
Will had never worked a major drug case.
I don't know much about the organization. Los Texicanos started back in the mid-60s at the Atlanta Pen. The population demographic back then was almost the exact reverse of what it is now. 70% white, 30 black. Crack cocaine changed that overnight. It worked faster than forced busing. There were still only a handful of Mexicans in the joint, and they ganged up to keep from getting their throats cut. You know how it goes.
Will nodded. Just about every gang in America had started as a group of minorities, be they Irish, Jewish, Italian, or other, banding together for survival. It generally took a couple of years before they started doing worse than was done to them.
What's the structure? Pretty loose. No one's going to chart like MS-13.
She was referring to what was often called the most dangerous gang in the world. Their organizational structure rivaled the military's, and their loyalty was so fierce that they'd never been successfully infiltrated. Amanda explained,
"In the early years, Los Texicanos was on the front page of the paper every single day, sometimes in both editions. Shootouts in the street, heroin, pot, numbers, prostitution, robbery, their calling card was branding children. They didn't just go after the person who crossed them. They'd go after a daughter, son, niece, nephew. They'd cut open their faces, once across the forehead, then a vertical line down the nose to the chin."
Without thinking, Will put his hand to the scar along his jaw.
"There was one point during the Atlanta child murders investigation when Los Texicanos was at the top of our list. This was early on, the fall of 79. I was the glorified assistant to the senior liaison for Fulton, Cobb, and Clayton. Evelyn was on the Atlanta task force, mostly fetching coffee until it was time to talk to the parents. Then it all fell to her. The general consensus was that the Texicanos were trying to send a broader message to the clientele. It seems ludicrous now, but at the time, we were hoping it was them."
She switched on the blinker and changed lanes.
"You were around 4 then, so you won't remember, but it was a very tense time. The entire metro area was terrified."
"Sounds like it," he said, surprised she knew his age.
"It wasn't long after the child murders that one of the top Texicanos was taken down during an internal struggle. They're tight-knit. We never found out what happened or who took over, but we know the new guy was much more business-oriented. No more violence for the sake of violence. He prioritized the business, taking out the riskier component. His motto was to keep the coke flowing and the blood off the streets. Once they went underground, we were glad to ignore them."
"Who's in charge now?"
"Ignacio Ortiz is the only name we have. He's the face of the gang. There are 2 others, but they keep an incredibly low profile, and you'll never find all 3 of them together in the same place. Before you ask, Ortiz is in Phillips State Prison, serving his 3rd year of 7 without parole for attempted manslaughter."
"Attempted? That didn't sound very gangbanger."
"Came home and found his wife tossing the sheets with his brother. Story goes, he missed on purpose."
Will assumed Ortiz had no trouble running his business from prison.
"Is he worth talking to?" "Even if we had cause, he wouldn't sit with us in a room without his lawyer, who would insist that his client is just an average businessman who let his passion get the best of him."
"Has he ever been arrested before?"
"A few times in his younger days, but nothing major."
"So the gang's still under the radar?"
"They come out every now and then to school the younger kids. Do you remember the Father's Day murder in Buckhead last year?"
"The guy who had his throat slit open in front of his kids?" She nodded.
30 years ago, they would have killed the children, too. One might say they've gotten softer in their old age."
"I'd hardly call that soft."
"Inside the joint, the Texicanos are known as throat slitters.
The gentleman in the trunk is high up on the food chain."
"Why do you think that?"
"He's only got 1 tattoo." Young gang members generally used their bodies as a canvas to illustrate their lives, etching tattoos of teardrops under their eyes for every murder,